Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I'm the Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today on this suddenly rainy Bay Area day, I have the pleasure of speaking with someone in New York City, Sri Srivanathan. Am I saying your last name correctly?
That's okay. Don't worry about it. I have a tape of all my anchors on television just killing the names, including some very famous people. So you're joining very good company. But the name is Srinivasan.
Srinivasan. Okay. There we go. And I should know this because while I was at Columbia, he was actually one of the professors there and continues to be a Columbia journalism professor and is now dean of students, as well as WNBC-TV's tech reporter. So welcome to our program.
Well, thank you. And one of the things actually, you know, as part of the changing media landscape, actually, I've just I'm done with my official NBC capacity as a local TV reporter. I'm going to continue to do kind of guest spots for them, but I'm working on a small startup project. So I can't quite talk about that yet, but it just shows you how everything is changing all around us. And by the way, it's raining out here in New York also.
Oh, well, good. We're all in the same company. It's probably a little less humid, but, you know, we welcome you anytime if you want to change climates.
Yes, thank you.
So let's start out by talking, I mean, obviously you're, you know, for those of you that are listening from the West Coast, you might not know, Sri is very well known, very well connected. You're a member of a few associations. You want to talk about some of the associations that you're part of because you really drive a lot of the activity and loop a lot of the rest of us into Saja's, you know, conversations and that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, thank you. Well, my work outside of Columbia has been with a couple of nonprofits that I've focused on. One is the South Asian Journalists Association, which has a very nice Bay Area chapter and chapters around the country. We're celebrating our 15th anniversary. And Saja is an example of an organization that is completely digital and uses the web. We had a website up in 95, and since then we've used everything from iPhone apps to Twitter feeds to get our work done. So you can check out what we do. Saja HQ is our Twitter feed address, and saja.org, S-A-J-A.org, and sajaforum.org. We use blogging tools as well. And also I was present at the founding of the Online News Association, which is the largest group of online journalists. And I was the founding administrator of the Online Journalism Awards, which was the world's largest online prizes and is doing very well and is no longer housed at Columbia, but is doing very important work. And you can learn about the Online Journalists Association by going to journalists.org. We couldn't get ona.org because it was owned by the Ontario Nurses Association or something. So,
of course.
And that's one of the lessons, obviously, if you talk about kind of web stuff, getting early and getting your name and booking it is really important, even if you don't have stuff ready. I learned that the hard way, by the way, Jennifer, because my web address is sri.net, www.sri.net. I also have sritips.com, sreetips.com. But I don't have Sri.com. Sri.com is a chain of motels in Florida. And
oddly enough.
And many years ago, I wrote to the guy saying, this is probably 98. So this guy was thinking way ahead. So I wrote to him and said, I'll pay you $500 for the address. And he said, look, you could give me $5,000. I wouldn't give it to you because that's my identity. And that really drove home to me the importance of your cyber identity. My revenge has been that every day he gets email intended for me, and he will once a year write to me saying, please don't send people. I say, it's not my fault. It's but the main thing is that also what has changed over all these years is that people will find you using Google and other tools. So as long as your Google ranking is high, and I'm the first three on Google when you search SREE, the rest of it sort of doesn't matter.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's something that we, you know, or I have been kind of obsessed with for a long time, which is SEO. In fact, my boss was writing an email to someone saying that Jennifer dreams of SEO. I'm not sure I quite dream of it, but I think it's going to be interesting, especially with Media Bistro holding a Web 3.0 that's supposed to be about the semantic web and having just gone to Web 2.0 Expo in San Francisco, talking to some search companies, and a lot of excitement around it, and I'm really not sure how far that technology is going to be really away from us. But that kind of gets us away from the topic at hand, which is really how influence has changed, as you said, over the years, you know, it has. It's you know, even in the you know, little bit less than 15-year lifespan of my career, I started out as a local TV journalist and got to collect phone calls from prison from the very nice men who wanted to chat with me, as I was saying at a talk last night. And, you know, quickly went into new media because I was just really interested in technology and very savvy to it. So was lucky to get a lot of experience and actually sign at our ABC affiliate, signed the first contract for an ABC O&O with Broadcast.com when Mark Cuban still owned it. So, you know, going way
back. Yeah, you
back
were early, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago. You know, convincing stations that content is a good thing as opposed to a problem is really, really key. But I think one of the things that I always ask people, especially distinguished folks like yourself who are in the academic community, and I know what it's like to be at Columbia, you know, where you spend more time, or you sometimes I feel like you have the luxury of spending more time thinking more deeply about things, and maybe you don't because you do have an administrative role as well, and you've got your hands in a lot of places, but how do you define influence? So I would consider you influential, because if I email someone at Media Bistro and I say, Shree sent me, they're going to answer my email, you know, whereas they may not answer every member's email right away. So you have some level of influence, social capital, you know, the whole point of the new book, The Woofy Factor. How are you defining influence these days?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's very nice. My own influence may be overrated, but I would say what I concentrate on, and I tell my students, I talk to them a lot about building your brand or your kind of platform for your work. There was a time when your work sort of spoke for itself, and now in this increasingly cluttered world, you've got to stand out, because kind of lifelong jobs or even lifelong careers in a certain kind of industry are just more and more difficult to pin down. And mm-hmm. So whatever you can do, because the loyalty that you have to the institution is unlikely to be repaid, you've mm-hmm. got to be ready to go and try new things. And it's almost too late. Once you're about to be fired, it's too late. I mean, you've got to use the branding when you can, and build that brand as much as you can, as early as you can. So what I'm thinking about a lot is how are people able to cut through the clutter and show their authority. And I've been a big champion of blogs, and been doing lots of workshops on how to use blogs to kind of establish that authority. Whether you're a journalist, whether you're in PR or you're with a company, it doesn't matter. The idea is establish your authority, and then people will turn to you. And Ken Lehrer of the Huffington Post talks about this, that it used to take 25 years ago, it used to take 25 years to build a brand. 10 years ago, it used to take 10 years to build a brand. Now you can build a brand in 1 or 2 years. Depending on how savvily you use technology.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you look at the Barack Obama brand, you know, it didn't exist until 2004 on the national
stage.
And 4 years later, he's president of the United States. And he didn't do it all because of technology, obviously. But you got to have some substance and have authority and then use technology, use media to kind of inject influence into what your existing brand is, and then you can rise above all the other clutter. And to think that he could have gone on to beat a former first lady and former vice presidential candidate and former senator of 30 years experience and Joe Biden and all of those people. I mean, it's all about having something to say, first of all, and
mm-hmm.
being interesting, and then people responding to that. So you can't do this. You know, the thing with blogging and stuff is anybody can blog. That doesn't mean everybody should blog.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
So as long as you have something to say, you can use technology in a savvy way to elevate and get attention to your ideas. So it's not like a popularity contest. Right now on Twitter, for example, and I don't know what level of technology you want to talk about, but on Twitter a lot of people are trying to just get a lot of followers, and just and what I say is, don't worry about that. I don't know if you talk about Twitter on your show.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
go for it.
Yeah, so one of the things, obviously, unlike almost any other service where you see the number of the people following you like right in your face. So people therefore then focus on that and try to game it and build it up and have followers. And I tell people, don't obsess about the followers, because if you do, that's having 10,000 followers out of which 9,000 don't care about you, there's no point. On the other hand, if you have a couple of thousand people or even a couple of hundred people, it depends on who is following you and how much they're loyal to you rather than how many. The overall number doesn't matter. But most people don't agree with me and they obsess about it. I would rather have, you know, 10 really good, interesting people follow me than try to build a network of tens of thousands. But so the answer may not be 10, and the answer may not be tens of thousands, somewhere in the middle. But don't obsess about it, because there's so much churn also in all those numbers. If you look at, there's a tool I use called twitter.grader.com, G-R-A-D-E-R.
HubSpots, yeah.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And what they do is they show you kind of the history of people and their followers. So if you look at that and you look at someone like Ashton Kutcher, who was very clever in the way of using Twitter to build up his own attention, you'll see that he crossed 1 million before CNN, and then got close to 2 million. He lost like 500,000 people also as fast. So the total number of people who used to follow him and have stopped following him are also a giant number. And that's what a lot of people don't get.
Yeah, and it's also worth saying that, you know, Twitter, you know, is clearly a place where influencers have been thought to prey. There's been a couple of developments, though, in the last couple of weeks. One, Oprah's entered the fray. So her number of followers was huge because, of course, she brings a lot of, you know, social capital or fame, however you want to phrase it, to the table. So, of course, people are interested in what she has to say and trust that she has a level of authenticity that is real. But there was a transaction where CNN actually purchased a handle. So when we go to Twitter, for those of you that don't know, twitter.com/whatever someone's name or their nickname is, whatever they've called themselves. And one thing I urge people to do, as Sri was pointing out earlier, is in the branding exercise, I always counsel people when I'm out speaking, grab your name, because there is no business model. So that purchase that happened, you know, that was announced last week was the first time we really heard of any kind of monetization or money-changing hands over handles on Twitter. And Twitter isn't really sure what to do about it yet. They didn't really have a comment on it. If you email their PR department, which is really the only way to get a hold of them except for, you know, inside contacts that you might have, they just are ignoring emails. They're not even getting back to people about it. So I find that really interesting. What is your sort of take on that? Do you urge people to grab their name even if they're not necessarily going to use it right away?
I think that it is useful to have your name. If you're going to be someone who's out there, and it depends on your line of work, you know, if you're just going to never be online, then it doesn't matter. But if you're in a business where you're trying to influence people, get attention to your work, connect with people, then you got to literally connect with people. And this is just one tool. I talk about Facebook, I talk about Twitter, I talk about LinkedIn. And then among them, you decide which one you're going to do to exert that influence, as you've been saying.
Right. So, you know, I tend to agree with you in terms of, you know, the issue of followers. You know, I have more than 1,000 followers. Do they listen to or read every tweet that I put out there? I don't know, but I hope so. You know, that's obviously the goal, and I think, you know, the main purpose. But
I saw a great line, by the way. Somebody said, you'll get more followers on Twitter if you stay off Twitter more often. And what he was saying was, live an interesting life and people will follow you. If you're just constantly on there spewing out stuff that no one's interested in, then they're not going to follow you.
And I thought
that was very, very brilliant thought.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of something that Jane Pauley had said. I happened to see her speak.
Wow, that's a name I haven't thought of in a long time.
I know, me either. But Jane Pauley, for those of you that are too young to remember, was the longtime co-host of the Today Show. And she...
Yeah, one of the most famous people on TV, because she also hosted Dateline NBC for many years.
Absolutely, with Stone Phillips, who when I was at NBC was there, and it was very strange when he was up going up to the gym to be running around the building and doing things. But in any event, I remember her saying, you know, advising people that were interested in careers in journalism, and that was something else I was going to ask you about since admissions seem to be up, or that's what the reports seem to say. But before we get to that, what Jane Pauley had advised people is be a history major. Learn what the world's about. Learn from, you know, what's happened before us or whatever makes you passionate. Be a philosophy major. Be an interesting person, because when it comes to those times where you have, you know, if your goal is to be a network anchor, hopefully your banter is genuine. And then, you know, you look ahead, you know, that was probably 20 years ago that I heard her say that. And now we're in this age of authenticity and, you know, being real. And so what you're saying could not be more true, that, you know, if you're not an interesting person, if you're just, you know, oh, I'm at the Potrero bus stop, not only is that kind of revealing where you are and potentially dangerous for cyber stalkers, frankly, which I worry about for folks, but, you know, the other side of that is that, you know, it's not incredibly enticing. So, you know, having something interesting to say is clearly important. But getting back to this concept that, you know, the media, you know, is sort of not breaking down, but it's definitely changing. I mean, obviously, it's very different than it used to be. As you said, you're stepping away from your more traditional TV role, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, so maybe you're going through, you know, or have gone through some thoughts about this beyond just admissions, but, you know, the reports are that admissions are up to journalism schools.
Yeah, it's really strange. Our admissions at Columbia Journalism School is up 40%.
Wow.
And in bad economies, people do go back to school, but that accounts for, I'd say, 10% increase.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
When you say, you know, that much, it's pretty stunning. And it's also that people really want to do what they want to do. We have people, hundreds of people who apply to Columbia's poetry program, for example. And people want to be poets, and people want to be journalists and want to tell stories. And there's more journalism being consumed than ever before. It's just that the business model is what's broken and needs fixing. But I don't think journalism is broken itself. So it's just the business model. The business of journalism is broken or breaking or having trouble.
So when you say that, I think a lot about, you know, in terms of journalism and how it's broken. I had a long conversation with a friend of mine, Spencer Christian, who's at ABC7. You may remember him from Good Morning America, another
sure.
name from the past, right?
Yeah.
So he's the co-host of a local daytime talk show on ABC7 here, as well as, you know, his weather gig
He's great. I remember him. He was
He's a fantastic guy, great father, just a really nice man. And in any event, we were talking about, you know, one of the things that I worry about in terms of the breakdown of newspapers, and, you know, some of them digitizing is fine, but a lot of them seem to be going away, especially in smaller markets. That's the trend that I see. Would you say that's wrong?
No, I mean in terms of what kind of jobs are you talking about?
Well, what I'm kind of getting at is what in television I learned. So when I started out as a Cub reporter, I learned to comb newspapers, because newspapers, basically the reason is, and it's not explained to you this way, but newspapers have these great beat reporting systems where you have folks that are on a beat. They have relationships with the city council people or public works folks or whomever to be able to get the great investigative journalism pieces that take time, that, you know, require relationships where people are willing to go on the record possibly, or, you know, provide you with people that will go on the record to uncover malfeasance and things that the public, you know, again, what journalism is about, you know, things that are in the public interest. And so one of my concerns is, you know, I know TV is changing a lot, but I don't see them filling that void. Do you see that void being filled? I mean, we talk
about
citizens.
No, it's really hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's also the accountability journalism that we need to have, where people are holding governments and local governments and business accountable for their practices and what they're doing. And people are crying out for that kind of information. They just haven't found a way to fit in the traditional television and everything else, newspapers into their lives. And that's the problem. But we need more of this stuff. There's no doubt about it.
So I think that ties really nicely into this sense of authority that you were talking about, because I think, you know, that's definitely something, you know, we actually this week were evaluating tools to determine, because one of the things, you know, I'm obsessed with is if we're going to talk about, I don't care if you're a communications company or, you know, or not, you know, my role is as a social media expert, to me, is a lot like being a journalist these days, right? So I'm supposed to be the keeper of, you know, we need to be transparent. We need to try to observe what the customer needs and, you know, try to get information out there as quickly as possible to help and be a conduit for a two-way exchange between companies and people. So that's kind of how I see my role. But, we actually demoed a product, I think, last week that, you know, is trying to help firms like ours, even journalism, it could be journalism students, it could be a journalist, determine the authority ranking of blogs better than we have. Because there's tools like Social Mention that I happen to like a lot because it's an aggregator and it tells us, you know, kind of how much people are blogging about a particular topic. But it doesn't show us.
What is that product? Which one? What's it called?
It's socialmention.com.
Okay.
And I really like it because it, you know, it looks at blogs. You can look just at blogs and segments. So you can look at blogs, microblogs, video, comments. It's a fabulous tool, and I've mentioned it before. And I really like it. You know, I like the idea of mention. But the thing that it can't do, and then, you know, there's Meltwater, which can tell you the authority ranking of a particular blog based on traffic, or you can go to compete.com or Quantcast and find out, you know, what the traffic ranking is. But what it doesn't tell you is the relationship of these blogs to one another and how much they talk about any particular topic. So if there's a niche-y topic that is relevant to you, so, you know, again, going back to kind of this idea of a beat or a business, either way, you're going to want to, you know, so let's say it's public works architecture, something kind of, you know, really specific and niche-y. It's hard to find out, you know, kind of what the authority is. And I think people are trying to figure out search algorithms that can help that. But I'm not sure technology is really going to solve that problem. So the bigger
I agree. It's along those lines. I would say people always ask me, you know, what are Twitter feeds I should follow or blogs I should read? And I say, all I can do is give you some guidelines, but it's like buying a sweater. You have to actually go try it out for a day or two or wear it and see what works. And only then can you decide. And I really believe that. So I will give people, you know, here are some blogs that might work for you, but you've got to look at it and go back and you have to use your own judgment to judge blogs and Twitter feeds and websites and all of that. And you have to create that. You have to do some work. It's not so easy and you can't rely on Google to do that.
Yeah, I wonder too. I mean, given that you have the media background that you do, I have the media background that I do. Do you feel like television stations may have missed the boat in the fact that they've long underestimated people?
The TV has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
to the lowest common denominator.
Well, because they have to. I mean, that's I don't want to make excuses for television, but the way the television is created is, especially national TV, is that you have to be relevant and interesting to people in market 210 and in market number 1. And they're going to have different interests. And so you have to write for somewhere in the middle, and it's hard. And that's why you see some shows, for example, shows that I love on TV, and I wonder why it's not on the big national broadcast is because certain people won't relate or like it. So I can give you just off the top of my head shows like Monk is going off the air this year.
Yeah.
Set in the Bay Area, of course. And it's just a fantastic show, but it was on USA, which is, of course, a big network, but is not on primetime on NBC. I think they were running it for a while on NBC. But or you look at shows that are on NBC and are critical hits but are not popular hits beyond a point, you know, including The Office and 30 Rock. They get lots of awards but don't get as many viewers as they should. So that's when you say, has TV failed? It's also that they are not on local news. When you look at local TV, the local news is not very user-friendly. It is all still catering to kind of lean-back media where you sit back and have television happen to you when, in fact, people want to lean forward and do things and take action.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, one of the most frustrating things for me was I was executive producing a show during the O.J. Simpson trial, and I was not allowed to use, per my news director, the word convicted because, you know, there were a set of legal terms that, you know, it was felt by the committee of my general manager and my news director would not be understood by enough people that, you know, it wouldn't be worth saying. So, you know, after a while, you know, that trial went on forever and ever. And, you know, you have to disclose that, as more and more salacious things came out, and hopefully we weren't covering too much salacious stuff, but as more things came out, photographs and that sort of thing, you know, disclosed that no one was convicted of a crime. And we say that now as though it's no big deal, but at the time, no one was really, you know, trial speak was something no one was really talking about. This was, you know, of course, before court TV, or during the time court TV was on the rise. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, nomenclature counts for a lot, and I find that was one of the things at Columbia that I chatted to my professors quite a lot about was, you know, having had the experience of coming from local and network experience, you know, how do you find that sweet spot in the middle where you feel like if you are in local, you know who your audience is, you generally have, you know, good information about, you know, kind of the archetypes of people that watch, so you know age groups and gender and that sort of thing. You know, so how far do you go down the path of not kind of speaking down to them, I guess, is the thing. And in this generation, I wonder how much we have disenfranchised by doing that.
Oh, boy, that's a really tough question. I'm not really sure, and I don't think we will even know the answer because it's just changing so quickly. It's tough. Let me think about that a little bit. We'll come back to
have I stumped you?
Yeah, well, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm going to sound even more vague than I usually do. So let me think about that.
Okay. Well, we're at the halfway point here. Yeah. So for those just joining us, I want to welcome you to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay of Eastwick Communications. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And this week we're speaking with Sri Srivanasan. Is that, am I saying it right now?
Well, two strikes, but that's okay.
Oh,
you know, that's why on my website, the first thing you'll see there is this, how to pronounce my name.
I know, and I meant to have that pulled up when I said it the second time, especially.
So if you go to Sri.net, you can see it.
Exactly,
right,
exactly.
Yeah. That's okay, don't worry. You're in great company. As
I'm not sure that makes me feel better. I usually try to be better at that. But anyway, he is a Columbia Journalism professor, esteemed Columbia Journalism professor, dean of students, as well as a former WNBC TV tech reporter, and you were at WABC as well, right?
Yes, I did. I was
you were there,
6 years at WNBC, at WABC, and 2 years at WNBC.
So you were at WABC, I think, when I was a J school student.
That's correct, yeah.
So anyway, one of the things that we have kind of thrown around here is this idea of media, the word media. And again, I go back to, you know, I think the importance of definitions because what media is, and you include blogs, we include blogs too at my communications company, and I think that's an important distinction to make that, you know, bloggers are out there making a name for themselves and have authority, and because they have authority, and are, you know, hopefully in some cases trying to make the same kind of difference a journalist is, and really, you know, it really starts to be indistinguishable at some point. But broadly, how do you define media these days? What do you include, and specifically, what do you not include?
Well, I include everything that you've said, because people are consuming more media and more information than ever before, and they're doing it in a variety of ways. And when people think of Twitter, they think, well, is that really media? Well, it is, because it's pointing to people getting information. Parts of Wikipedia are like the media, because they have Wikinews and other things. Somebody said to me the other day they didn't believe that B. Arthur was dead until they read it on Wikipedia. And how far have we come, where people
wow.
didn't trust anything on Wikipedia, to where Wikipedia has a sense of authority on some things. It is not the only... I am skeptical at everything I read there, but boy, do I read it.
And, absolutely.
And,
I'm more skeptical of it than I would be looking for it as my source of authority, but
right.
yeah.
And one of my colleagues and friends, Andrew Lee, L-I-H, is andrewlee.com, has written a book called The Wikipedia Revolution, How a Bunch of Nobodies Created the World's Greatest Encyclopedia. And what's fascinating about that is, as I'm sure you know, Encarta was shut down, the Microsoft big encyclopedia project. And
yep.
they had to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on it, and
a
it shut down. And here was, these nobodies were able to do something. Now, again, I want to emphasize that Wikipedia is far from perfect, but it is a really interesting example of how people are able to use information like that and trust some of it, discount a lot of it, but it's the first stop. And journalists themselves are among the most skeptical, but I think, and at the same time, gullible when it comes to all these sources, because they are easily manipulatable, if that's a word, by whatever they see out there. You know, if a mistake happens in one story, you'll see it repeated down to the typo in other articles, because people go with what they know. And
absolutely.
I used to call this like the Nexus virus, where they just quote the same things again and again. And now it's sort of Google virus, I guess. But what I spend my time telling people is that there are so many new and interesting sources and authorities that you can quote if you are out there listening. And so things like blogs, things like Facebook, things like Twitter are tools to listen, not just promote yourself. And in terms of how you promote yourself on these things, I think if you only post one in every four things about you and your pet projects, I think that's about the right ratio, because the other three things are what people will stay for. If four out of four things are about what you ate and what you did and who you had dinner with, they'll be like, eh, and people won't be interested. But once in a while, then it changes things. You know, a lot of people dismiss Twitter and Facebook because people are saying, I had a pastrami sandwich, I'm having a shower, I'm having this, I'm having that. But, you know, if it's Ruth Reichel who's Twittering, I want to know what pastrami sandwich she ate. She, as you know, is the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and New York
mm-hmm.
Times top film food critic. And if she's eating a pastrami sandwich and writing about it, I want to know. But my friend Bob, I don't want to know what he's eating.
Yeah, it doesn't quite matter as much. What do you think, you know, we talked a lot about Twitter here, and I think it's worth talking about the other kind of event that's come out of Twitter besides Ashton Kutcher, how you mentioned him earlier. But, you know, Oprah coming on the scene, I thought it was funny, you know, and a lot of people have noted how she started her first post all in caps. All of us that come from the TV world know probably why that was, because when you write scripts, you write them all in caps for the teleprompter. So that
right, because the all caps makes you slow down when you read.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in any event, so yeah, those of us that have worked in the media have had to, you know, and that do other forms of media or work in other forms of media, have to learn that that is a form of yelling, of course, by online etiquette standards. But a lot of people, there was a social media club event that I was a part of last week, and we had a few authors there. Clara Shai, who wrote The Facebook Era, and had her book launch last night. Tara Hunt, who wrote The Woofy Factor, and John Hagel, who has written tons of books, starting as far back as 1997, talking about social networking, and proud to say that, you know, was reading his books back then, and, you know, very interesting, you know, didn't really think about the kind of connections he was talking about being real until now. And, you know, there was definite at this event, and I think in general among my peers, this sense that, you know, Twitter's hit the mainstream, and even the people that write for the Twitter handbook. So if you go to twitterhandbook.com, you can get a free handbook that I think is a fairly good guide as to the, you know, the nomenclature and other things you need to learn, like hashtags on Twitter. But they're talking about Twitter kind of going away, as though it sort of died in a sense because it's hit this, it's hit the masses. What do you make of that? What do you think of that? Do you have an opposite take?
I mean, that's interesting because I've been getting a lot of questions about Twitter. When you say it's hit the mainstream, I'm not convinced it has. You know, whatever the number of users, let's say when it's 20 million people, let's say 50 million. I don't think it's anywhere close to that, right? Let's say 50 million, 60 million people.
Well, we know they're not going to the actual site, but we know that they're using,
sure.
And that was the other statistic that came out this week, is that people are using tools like TweetDeck, et cetera,
sure.
to access it. So
yeah. No, I think it certainly hit the kind of people who are influencers themselves, the TV folks, some of the celebrities, things like that. But the average person isn't using it yet. And by the way, a lot of people who are very tech savvy, who love Facebook, are among the biggest Twitter skeptics I've ever met. And it's amazing. People who love Facebook and don't love and hate Twitter. And that's partly because they dismiss it as this, you know, whatever, pastrami sandwich eating announcements. But I tell people that you wouldn't dismiss email just because there are all these African princes trying to make you rich. You found valuable things to do in email. By the way, your boss is on email, and your friends and family are on email,
mm-hmm.
so you found
mm-hmm.
a use for it. Same thing with Twitter. If it is used correctly, it can be a very powerful tool. The problem with Twitter is that it's not very friendly to newcomers. When you first go in there and you follow the wrong people, you suddenly see all these hashtags and at signs and disjointed conversations, and some of us are trying to kind of clean that up and think about how they're posting and what we're posting, and those are the things that I would encourage people to think about.
That's interesting. I think, you know, it's still, you know, for the people that were early influencers, so the way I kind of look at it is you've got the Robert Scobles of the world, and I'm sure you know who Robert Scoble is. He was an early or he was a blogger brought on by Microsoft years ago, and so he's one of the first really bloggers that made himself famous and branded himself and was very smart that way. And then more recently has been known for writing a column for Fast Company and doing video for FastCompany.tv, which he's broken away from, and he's doing some different things now. But it used to be that sort of he was kind of the standard bearer. If he followed you, that was a really big deal because Robert, you know, has some standards about who he will follow, and he tends to read you if he follows you. So, you know, now I look at it and I'm, you know, it's only a few months later and I go, God, you compare Robert Scoble, who, you know, I was speaking at an event last night in a suburb here in the Bay Area. You know, and I asked for a show of hands to find out if people knew who Robert Scoble was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you do a show of hands, do you know who Oprah is? And, of course, everyone knows who Oprah is. And I just think that's going to have some sort of lingering effect. I'm not sure what effect it will have, but I think what it tells me is that, you know, this idea, again, of, you know, and I think it'll be interesting to see how many people start reading The Woofy Factor, which is all about this idea of social capital and influence. But, you know, we retain it in whatever form of media that we're in, so you can make a big splash someplace else. I think the concept that you're teaching your students of, you know, branding themselves could not be more true, important, and real than in this example, because, you know, however you earn it, wherever you go, you should be, it should follow you.
Yep.
Which I think we can at least say in this example was true. But I'm curious about some of the other tools. When you teach your students, kind of, you know, what are some of the tools that you say, you know, in terms of new media, you go through? Is it, I mean, I think when I was there, it was a little bit more about, you know, creating your own website.
Now we talk about that, but it's also understanding social media. It's also using things like Twitter and Facebook better, using
mm-hmm.
LinkedIn better. It's also building audio slideshows. It's connecting with your audience and getting to understand how you talk to them and what should respond to them. All of that's important. And what's happening, and as I see it around us, is that we get a lot of folks who have journalism experience, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years experience, and they come back to learn sort of those digital skills. One of the people I always talk about is a guy named John Landman. Jonathan Landman, L-A-N-D-M-A-N, is one of the top editors of the New York Times and helps run their website. And he was brought back. He's a graduate of the school, and we brought him back to talk to our faculty and say, so what should we be teaching people who went to school, who are going to school 25 years after you did? And he said, I want every journalist to have a new media mindset and a new media skill set. And so you can learn the skills. Any 12-year-old can teach you how to set up a Facebook account, but they can't teach you how to use it properly, how to use it strategically, how to use it to amplify the points you're making, what you're saying. It's fascinating to see that.
So in this, and, you know, this is something that I struggle with, too, when I speak, and I, you know, I do my fair share of trying to split up, you know, doing some speaking for nonprofits that might need help, as well as, you know, the things that I need to do for visibility for the agency, and I guess my own social branding. But you know, really, you know, popping up a level, how much do you talk about tools versus the message or crafting that message? And, you know, Reagan.com today had a story out about, you know, old writing skills, forget it. You need to have X, Y, and Z in your toolkit of writing to be able to write effectively online. And they were talking online broadly, so for any tool set. How much do you think we focus too much as we try to educate on tools, because that's what people tend to be?
Yeah, because I talk about how the tools are going to change. And it's the same thing about Twitter or Facebook. I mean, they might go away, but the idea of short bursts of communication is here to stay. It's not focusing on the tools, but kind of understanding the big picture concepts behind them, and thinking like it's not focusing on YouTube, but the idea of how video and how people comment on them and push them out is going to be big and very important. Also understanding how things are connected online. As you know, kind of eyeballs are the currency of the internet now.
Mm-hmm.
And then learning how to build more eyeballs to you, but eyeballs that can be then monetized is also important.
Absolutely, that whole engagement metric of how long you can keep somebody. You know, I'm an analytics geek, so I love talking about analytics when I get into certain meetings and they're directors of sales or business development, and I start asking if they have pixel-based tracking and their new website design. They get very excited. People generally don't know what that is, so I won't bore people with it here. But I think, you know, it's definitely what I tell people is, you know, for my two cents is be nimble, you know, be open to change, because, you know, definitely tools will change. They will migrate. Twitter will get a business plan someday. And it's gonna impact how that information gets out. But again, if you have an interesting backstory, that's kind of the important thing. I think it's one of the reasons that I end up talking about my Peace Corps and AmeriCorps experiences so much, because those were probably the most you know, enriching experiences of my life. You know, you're on your own and learning, but, you know, you kind of go back to those things and see things through a different lens. Your worldview comes through. And if you don't have a worldview, especially, you know, students that can afford to go to Columbia, the worry would be for me, and I talked about this with some of my fellow colleagues, is a lot of them are getting the kind of eye-opening experience to life afterwards because parents, you know, aren't paying for their education anymore. So the hope is that, you know, that broad eye-opening experience happens during the process of going to journalism school and along the way through undergraduate school as well.
I think that's a great way to think about it.
You know, because otherwise, again, don't have that much to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you, too, so in terms of, you know, sort of social media basics, what do you think everybody that's interested in journalism, because I get this email a lot from people, you know, so what should I be doing right now? I'm interested in being a journalist. Where should I be? Now, of course, the answer is going to depend on kind of what they want to do. But broadly, what do you recommend? Where do you think the basics are, or where are the basic places they should be?
I keep a collection of about, I've stopped counting at about 36 social networking sites that I've received invitations to, things I've never heard of, things I've heard of. And I focused, and whenever I get an invitation, I say, thank you very much. I'm only on Facebook and only on LinkedIn and Twitter. That's it for now. That might change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on also something called Tumblr, but I don't join or follow anybody on that. And I have a MySpace account I don't use, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that these are the three that I found for my life that are just right. You might be in another field where something else is more appropriate, and that's fine. I don't use MySpace mainly because it feels like it's created by 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
And it's
we
see not for me. But if you're a music person or you're a music
journalist
or anything in music, you absolutely have to be there.
Absolutely.
So you have these different tools for different things, and you have to be nimble and able to change and able to come around. And somebody said to me the other day, oh, you know, I don't want to spend all that time learning how to do Facebook because then it might change. I say, there is absolutely no guarantee that this will stick around. But you want to understand the concepts, and then the rest of it will just shake out.
So, you know, one of the things, a couple weeks ago I had Augie Ray on, who writes for Experience, the blog, and I really love his blog because he has this approach where I find it very journalistic. He didn't go to journalism school, and he doesn't aim to be a journalist, but he sources a lot of what he writes. So I find that, you know, kind of methodical. I'd rather see one blog post a week that has sourcing where I can go deeper and really thoughtful posts. You know, and that's just my preference. Other people like sort of just pops of information. But I had him on, and we were talking about that very fact, you know, the sourcing versus non-sourcing of posts or making kind of commentary your business on a particular blog or media outlet, whether it be a podcast or videocast, whatever it is that you choose to do. Where do you think that so one of the things that, you know, struck me as we've been talking here is that, you know, I don't think that Augie Ray gets the audience that he really deserves, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have him on the program. He also had a nice contrarian point of view to kind of the point of this program, which is talking about influence. He was saying, does influence matter? So we had a nice discussion about that. And I think, you know, I wonder about that because I think, you know, there are enough tools out there like TweetLater, you know, is one of the ones we encourage our clients to use where it has a pay model, but in the free model, because I am a big proponent of free, you can just add keywords. So, you know, of course, I tell people to track themselves, track their company as appropriate, and markets and verticals. And then they can get a digest sent to them every 4 hours, every day, every week, and participate in conversation one-on-one with people based on the digest that they receive. So that's one way, you know, you can use Twitter's tools, you know, all of the things that have been built and the wikis that exist to tell you how to cut through the noise, break through the noise, to get to people that you want to have one-on-one conversations with on Twitter. How do you think that happens in blogs? I mean, how do you think people are finding blogs to follow? And, you know, how does influencer happen there?
With blogs?
Yeah.
It's having, again, some useful things to say, but also to having a really quality audience. And you have to have the right people following you. I think we talked about that a little bit. And
yeah.
Blogs is from establishing that what I get from you is better than anything I would get anywhere else. If you can do that, then you're going to be all set. And if you can't do that, then you're going to be in trouble. So that's I think, the way to go, though not everybody understands that, I think.
So what do you think, you know, if somebody was starting out and they were wondering, you know, what kind of blog should I start? Do you guys talk about that, talk about the different approaches to blogging?
Do we talk about that at school? Oh, yeah, we'd look at,
several
different ways. I have a handout where I, as part of my workshop, that you can find at 3tips.com.
Mm-hmm.
Where I have that, and I often talk about blogging-related stuff on my Twitter feed also, which is twitter.com/SreeNet, S-R-E-E-N-E-T.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I would say that you have to understand that different blogs have different reasons, different ways of working, different functionality, and if you don't understand that, then you are just going to get stuck because nobody's following you, nobody's listening to you. And so I think influence does matter, by the way. After having spent 51 minutes talking about it, I think the other guest you were mentioning is wrong, that influence is important.
Yeah.
Why do we do what we do? It's to change people's minds or help them in some way. And that's what I would say about Twitter or Facebook, that I try to be strategic about what I post, and I will post things that are either entertaining, useful, fun, some combination of those every time I can. So even if I'm posting that I'm at the museum, I try to give a tidbit or a fact that nobody else might have or start a conversation. And once you do that, I think you're much better off. And that's what I have found consistently as I've been doing this. But at the same time, I think the more that you engage and listen on these services instead of constantly telling people what you're doing, the better off you'll be. And the final point I'll make on all of this, I think, is that there's this false intimacy on Facebook and Twitter. I told you, this is the first time I'm actually saying out loud that I'm doing another big project on media. I mean, this is on your show.
Breaking news.
And but I'm not announcing all the details. But if you people who watch me on Facebook, or people on Facebook and Twitter always say to me, "Wow, you live I know everything about you." But well, here's something that I've been thinking about 40% of my time, and you don't know anything about it. So you can be judicious and thoughtful and strategic in what you post. You don't have to. Every time you're having a sandwich, you don't have to tell people.
No, and you really should be.
Yeah.
But
there are so many people
be.
Who aren't like that, and it's very irritating.
It can be. So one of the questions that I have for you is what, you know, as someone who is teaching, I assume you are still pretty ingrained in teaching classes.
Yes.
Even though you are dean of students, what's the most common question you're asked? And I should say this more broadly because, of course, you do speak other places and are available. You know, probably there are some people that probably will come up to you just because they know you. What do you think the most common question is that you're asked?
You mean about what particular topic though?
So they know you as kind of a web guru.
Yeah. So I mean, they just ask, how do you deal with information overload? How do you answer all the emails you get? I recently wrote a piece about the 5th anniversary of Gmail,
and
I'm the only person I've been able to find in the world that I know, that obviously there must be other people, who pays Google $75 a month because I needed extra Gmail space. I ran out of 6 Gmail accounts at some point.
Oh,
and So someone posted on my Facebook group, they wrote a line that says, somewhere in the bowels of Gmail, there is a spreadsheet of the finances of Google, and it says, income from extra inbox space, $75, and my name. And the answer is, I don't get to answer every single thing, but if you are writing to somebody, if you're listening to me now, for example, you want to connect with me, write to me at sree@sree.net, S-R-E-E at S-R-E-E.net. Put one line on there, you know, Jennifer's webcast or anything else that would make it relevant. It's not because I'm so famous or I'm busy or anything like that. You have to reestablish in cyberspace the connections you might have in the rest of the world or in the real world, and just
mm-hmm.
quick line in the subject line that you get someone's attention, and then if it's interesting, people will respond.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, there's a lot of books out right now that are of interest to people. What are the books that you, you know, maybe that you teach with or that you find the most interesting that are either new or that...
Well, you've been naming a lot of interesting books. So I would just say there's just a lot going on. I've been reading and talking about my really good friend Andrew and his book on Wikipedia.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Even though it's not, it's about Wikipedia, but it's also about this whole world of how authority and influence are changing. So that's an example
uh-huh.
of the book I'm reading. But there's
and it's
so
a nice
many...
counterpoint to Wikonomics too, where you know it takes a different direction. Which
yeah, I've not read that. So
yeah, I think that the nice thing about it sounds like Andrew's book, and I haven't had a chance to read it, is that it sounds like it takes an approach that more of us can relate to. It's not about, you know, trying to monetize.
Oh no, it's not. It's really about the story and what are the lessons from it. And
absolutely,
you can learn about his book at andrewlieh.com.
And we'll try to get as much of this into our blogs.eastwick.com page as possible, too.
Oh, great.
So, anyway, I'm sorry, continue. So
I'm curious about
the books that, you know, do you even have books as part of your curriculum, or do you
use
blogs?
We use lots of different things, including teaching people kind of big concepts for some of that stuff. Books are very important, but it's also important to go in and read beyond just what was published in the book itself, but to read about the debates about the book and the counterpoints and all of that. So it's a fascinating time. On my mind this morning, though, is a book that has nothing to do with any of this, a book I read last summer called
mm-hmm.
The Nine, The Secret World of the Supreme Court, because we're talking the day after
David Souter,
leaving the Supreme Court. And it's just such a fascinating world. And by the way, Souter is a guy who I think doesn't use email, any of those things.
Well, actually, I have an interesting Souter story.
Oh,
so I was actually.
We're running out of time, though, right? So.
Yeah, we are running out of time. But quickly, I was I was being told by professors, you know, apply for a Rhodes Scholarship, and I wasn't so sure. So I was writing to famous people that I could think of that were Rhodes Scholars, and he was one of the people that wrote me back, and I still have his letter. So it's pretty daunting and nice when you get, you know, Justice of the Supreme Court, and this really nice letter about what his experience was like as a Rhodes Scholar.
Oh.
Go figure.
Yeah, no,
so I got an individual letter from him back when people actually wrote letters.
Yeah, I think he still does. My wife is a Rhodes Scholar, and I know she'd be interested to hear that. That's nice.
Yeah, pass that along to her.
Yeah, I will.
So in terms of, you know, final thoughts here as we go into our last couple of minutes, you have obviously had the opportunity to educate a lot of different people. And I know that you have kind of been a fan. I think you called recently on the listserv, you had called somebody your Twitter mentor. But are there some students that you feel like are really standing out these days that you want to give a shout out to here
now? Oh, sure. There's a guy named Franz Strasser. I think that's who you're talking about. I learn a lot. I learn as much from my students as they do from me. Franz, Strasser, Franz Strasser. He's German. And you can find him on Twitter at Franz Strasser. And he's just terrific. And he's the kind of that mentality of understanding technology, but really cares about writing and reporting and is a good guy to boot. He's going to go far, as will anybody who has that combination are going to do fine.
Yeah, that mixed skill set that's so important. you never know what will help. You know, having done new media, you know, having gone the new media route, that was a huge risk for me back then. And a lot of people, you know, thought, you know, you had been on air. Why wouldn't you just continue being on air? And actually, when I went to Columbia, one of my goals was to get back on air. And that isn't the trajectory my career went afterwards. It just didn't make sense.
You're
going to
be,
people.
You're going to have food on the table for much longer than most folks who didn't, who don't get that and don't understand it and are going to regret that.
I hope so. Well, anyway, it's been lovely speaking with you. I want to thank everyone that's tuned in to this session of Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. And remember to tune in next week. Our broadcast schedule is available at blogs.eastwick.com, along with information from this program as we're able to collect it. The same place you can keep up with the latest on this show and Eastwick in general. Again, that's blogs.eastwick.com. I want to thank you again for listening. Thank you to Sri, our very distinguished guest, and have a great weekend, everyone. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.